Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Friday, August 28, 2020. Producing from his home studio in the foothills of Connecticut is Taylor Schwenk. I'm Buster Olney. Well, the protests for social justice continued within Major League Baseball on Thursday with more postponements, including the Mets and the Marlins, among seven games postponed. Some of the most striking moments were at Citi Field. Gary Cohen described what happened in SNY, which includes 42 seconds of silence, a nod to Jackie Robinson's number 42. Give it a listen.
And now Lewis Brinson announced as the leadoff hitter for Miami. And all of the Marlins and Mets have come out of their dugouts. Michael Wacha takes off his hat, and all the Mets on the field are removing their hats as well. And now, after a moment of silence that lasted 42 seconds, the day before we celebrate Jackie Robinson Day, the Mets are exiting the field after both teams exchanged a wave of caps to one another. So it would appear as though, after a poignant moment, that the Mets and Marlins will not be playing baseball tonight.
This, of course, in reaction all around sports to the weekend shooting by police of Jacob Blake in Kenosha, Wisconsin. Michael Conforto, Dellen Betances, Robinson Cano, and Dom Smith all talked about the message the team tried to impart.
We need to treat each other with respect, with kindness,
yes,
no matter your race, no matter where you come from. And, you know, I think it's as simple as that. And, you know, I think that's the message that we're putting out there tonight. You know, and I know these guys feel the same way. And yes, I don't know if they, you know, have anything else to add to that. But
well, all I'll say is, you know, we're just tired of all the injustice going in the black community. And, you know, it's time for a change. And, you know, we're using our platform as best as we can, so we can make a change. And, you know, there's no better way to do what we did tonight, united. And, you know, we're here for everybody that's suffering out there. That's the message we try to portray.
You know, even touching all of us, not only last night seeing Dom, but what even, you know, got people have been through this, and imagine we've been in their shoes. I mean, you know, I used to live in the neighborhood, and I know how it is, and it's hard when you're not can be yourself. I mean, it's really hard, and we're here to support Dom and all those people. And then we try to send a message to that, and that's what we do, to show Dom that we're on his side, and then we support him. He's a brother. We all love him in here, and then we're always going to be on his side.
I don't think we have to say much about it. I mean, we showed our action tonight that we're not just going to shut up and dribble, shut up and play ball. And we're going to stand for what we believe in, so... I don't think we have to speak too much on that. We showed them tonight by our actions.
That sound courtesy of MLB.com. The members of the Players Alliance are donating their Major League Baseball salaries to support the fight against racial inequality. The Alliance, which is made up of more than 100 black current and former players, announced Thursday that its members will donate their salaries from Thursday's and Friday's game to the organization to support its effort to combat racial inequality and aid black families and communities affected by recent events. MLB is celebrating Jackie Robinson Day on Friday during a week in which three games are postponed Wednesday and seven on Thursday. In the midst of all this, the New York Mets had another Mets kind of moment. General manager Brody Van Wagenen was caught on a hot mic, and he criticized Commissioner Rob Manfred for what he described a leadership mistake.
Mulling that over, baseball's trying to come up with a solution. Say, no, you know, it'd be super powerful. Three of us here can't leave this room. They're saying, you know, it'd be really great if you just have them all take the field. Then they leave the field. And then they come back and play at 8:10. And I was like, what?
What's it?
Rob. Jeff, scheduling's going to be a nightmare. There's so much at stake. And I said, Jeff, that's not happening.
They're not dealing with reality.
They're not playing, but that's Rob's instinct. And Rob, not exactly what you and I were talking about, at leadership level, he doesn't get it. He just doesn't get it. And
that's so...
Anyway, so I...
And Jeff wants to appease Rob.
Jeff wants to support the players first and foremost,
okay,
but he's also... You know,
but
he
it's,
has
hard,
to,
it's a hard spot for him.
He has to be the messenger for Rob to at least throw that to us. And I told Jeff, that's not happening, Jeff. These guys aren't playing. I just stopped it. I wasn't even going to take that.
Because it puts Jeff in a tough spot. If he's going to try to work with the commission, because you're right. These guys, that decision is sailed.
That's
ship is sailed.
Now, in case you couldn't hear that, here is what Brody said. And I said, Jeff, that's not happening. These guys aren't playing. But that's Rob's instinct. And Rob, at the leadership level, he doesn't get it. He just doesn't get it. After that video leaked, of course, social media exploded, and there were all kinds of ramifications within Major League Baseball. Van Wagenen apologized Thursday night, saying he falsely accused Manfred of proposing a plan that would have had the New York players stage a one-hour walkout during their scheduled home game against the Marlins. Van Wagenen apologized. Jeff Wilpon called Commissioner Manfred this afternoon to notify him that our players voted not to play. Van Wagenen said in a statement, they discussed the challenges of rescheduling the game. Jeff proposed an idea of playing the game an hour later. I misunderstood that this was the commissioner's idea. In actuality, this was Jeff's suggestion. The players had already made their decision, so I felt the suggestion was not helpful. My frustration with the commissioner was wrong and unfounded. Van Wagenen later told reporters he apologized to Manfred on the phone, noting that he recognized, quote, it was a disrespectful move to his office and to him. Manfred also put out a statement. So a complete mess there. We're going to be talking about that with Jeff Passan coming up. There were a handful of games that were played. The Dodgers and Giants, who had boycotted their game the day before, faced off in a doubleheader, and Mookie Betts reached a milestone.
And everybody participating today. That's hit number 1,000 for Mookie Betts in his career. A base hit for Mookie in the sixth. And he's past that career milestone now of 1,000 hits. Make sure
he gets that from Tim Neverett on the Dodgers television network. A.J. Pollock helped put the game away in the top of the seventh.
Pollock with a fly ball to left field. Deep, on its way, and gone! A two-run home run for A.J. Pollock. Pollock's seventh home run of the year. He's knocked in 17, and the Dodgers now have a 7-0 lead.
Charlie Steiner, AM 570 LA Sports. Clayton Kershaw was dominant in that first game. In game two, the Dodgers rolled again.
Seven pitchers now, when you include Kenley Jansen, combining to try and sweep this doubleheader. He struck him out, and the Dodgers sweep this doubleheader. They get shutouts in both games, 7-0 and 2-0.
Joe Davis on the Dodgers television network. The Padres and Mariners, who had their game postponed on Wednesday, played a doubleheader as well. And Fernando Tatis Jr. did what he's been doing a lot.
McGill to Tatis. Oh, my goodness. Deep to left field. Car rush. Ball going, ball long, long gone. Tatis, when he gets a first pitch fastball, bat through the zone, I'll put him up there with anybody in baseball. Now you get a ball game. Now you get a one-run ball game.
Ted Leitner, 97.3 The Fan. Now, the Padres fell behind and staged a wild comeback in the bottom of the seventh.
Runner at third belongs to Williams. Runner at first means nothing. High fly ball. Will Myers. Deep left field. Ball game's over. Ball game's over. Padres with a walk-off three-run home run. Celebrating at home plate. What a baseball team.
And what a day for Manny Machado through the two games of the doubleheader.
Two down on the first. Manny Machado coming up. Two homers in the first game. Now 1-2 to Manny.
In the air to left field. It's deep. It's far. And that ball is gone.
Two in the first game. Now another one here. And Fuego on fire. Manny Machado of the San Diego Padres.
We saw some great moments last year by Manny Machado, both sides of the baseball. But we have not seen the consistency he has been throwing out there as of late.
Yeah, think about these numbers. Since August 19th, Jose Abreu has 8 homers, Manny Machado 6 homers, and they have more homers than the Angels, Marlins, or Diamondbacks as teams. The Blue Jays traded for right-handed starting pitcher Taijuan Walker, agreeing to send a player to be named. Now, before we get to Jeff Passan and to Todd Radom, another reminder to check out the Hoop Collective with Brian Windhorst. Brian is actually in the bubble. He's on the ground. It's led to some really good podcasting. I'm interested to hear what's going on from his vantage point, as NBA players have, for now, effectively gone on strike. Listen to the Hoop Collective wherever you get your podcast.
Vivid Seats wants to get you to the games you love this spring. Experience every pitch, assist, and game-winning shot live and in person. And the best part? Each transaction is a step toward a free 11th ticket with Vivid Seats rewards. Score unbeatable perks like free tickets, surprise seat upgrades, and annual birthday deals. As the official ticketing partner of ESPN, Vivid Seats is offering you $20 off your first $200 ticket purchase with code BASEBALL. That's code BASEBALL. Visit VividSeats.com or download the app today. Vivid Seats. Experience it live. You can now stream the most MLB games on DirecTV without a satellite dish. Yes, the clutch hits, the strikeouts, grand salamis, web gems, with nothing on your roof. So whoever's up there, whether it's roofers, Santa, birds, old-timey chimney sweeps, moody teenagers, thrill-seeking raccoons, you name it, they won't find a satellite dish. But you will find your MLB games on DirecTV. That means DirecTV is your home for baseball this season. Root, 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 with nothing on your roof. Call 1-800-DIRECTV or visit DirecTV.com. Sign up today. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package.
Jeff Passan covers baseball for ESPN. Jeff, how you doing?
I'm doing great, Buster. How are you?
I'm hanging in there. If you needed any more evidence, the 2020 is such a different season. We are 3 days from the August 31st trade deadline. You got the superpower Yankees really need a starting pitcher. The Braves do as well. In any other year, to be talking about Mike Clevenger, Trevor Bauer, others, but not in 2020. Seven more games postponed on Thursday. Teams and players reacted to the shooting last weekend at Kenosha. And as you wrote yesterday, the response in baseball, however we want to define it, is evolving. And it feels like that the players are trying to gain traction, trying to figure out how to deal with this.
It's really interesting to see a nascent movement. And in baseball, Buster, you know this, there's been no traction in the past. I mean, there have been prominent black players, despite the dwindling number overall. There have been prominent black players in baseball since Jackie Robinson came around. And none of those players back 3 years ago knelt alongside Bruce Maxwell. And I think there's some disappointment among, there's some regret among them, but to see the level of protest in baseball that's happening right now is even more than I expected. I want to flash back a couple days ago and ask you this question. After the Milwaukee Bucks said they are not playing, I talked with 10 people who I consider to be not just smart, but have their finger on the pulse of what it's like in baseball. And none of them thought that there were going to be games postponed. Did you run into the same thing, or did you have a better sense that this was something that was going to happen and that was going to turn out like it has?
No, I heard exactly the same thing you did. And the reason why I think that we didn't necessarily know what was going to happen or didn't have a feel for it is because it happened so deeply in the grassroots, right? I mean, when you really think about what happened, you know, the Mets, for example, played and Dom Smith did his video. And then yesterday, the Mets reacted a day later to seeing Dom Smith weeping on camera.
Yeah.
The Dodgers, you know, with their reaction when they found out that Mookie Betts was not going to play, that Dave Roberts was not going to manage. The Dodgers, you know, reacted the night before. This is so different, and it's something I want to talk to you about. It's just so striking, you know, how baseball is so different than the NBA, where it feels like the players, it's everything is from the ground up, and there really isn't any collaboration, cooperation, even conversations that we're seeing sort of sport-wide. It's sort of like, well, you know what? I don't think I want to play. Oh, okay. So Mookie's not going to play? Well, you know what? We need to talk about that. Okay, we're not going to play. And then they inform the people they work for that they're not going to play. There's not really this collective conversation in the way that we see in the NBA.
No, and the collective conversation, I think, is sort of the next step. But I'm really glad, Buster, that there hasn't been. Because I think if this were mandated, if this were a top-down thing, it just would not have had the same resonance that it has. This is players coming to the decision as grown men, as adults, as empathetic human beings, as people who don't understand necessarily what's going on, but want to. And that to me is the biggest leap that I've seen taken in baseball. It's not that they're actually doing something, because what the result of these protests, what the result of these postponed games leads to, I don't know. Nobody knows. But they're at least showing curiosity. And sometimes that little spark is all it takes to light the fire. And I feel like the advocacy that's going to eventually grow out of this is going to be a lot bigger in baseball than I ever would have expected, just because I've grown used to this sport being on the sidelines when it comes to social justice issues.
Among the stories you've heard of players connecting in that way that you describe, what were some of them really stuck with you?
You know, I think the Players Alliance actually is owed a lot of credit. And this is something that has come together within the past few months. There are about 100 Black players and former players who are working together behind the scenes and trying to get on the same page in terms of things. And you saw Jack Flaherty, Buster, tweet out, you know, why can't we all just have a day where we do this together? And I think that day is here in Jackie Robinson Day. And I think that day is also coming in the future, because as slow as Major League Baseball has been to embrace some of these elements, I think they're starting to. I think they're starting to recognize that if you're going to celebrate a man like Jackie Robinson, whose legacy is that he changed a country, he changed the world by risking his own personal well-being, by risking his family, by risking his future, by risking everything, then you as an industry, as a sport, have to be out there too. And the problem with this is that baseball has this very culturally conservative, almost centering. I think most of the players, if you ask them, would consider themselves conservative and generally speaking, are going to be on the other side of the sorts of protests that are happening. Ownership at ownership levels, it's just as much so. There are people who are vehemently opposed to this and who are just going along with it because the inertia of the movement, Buster, is too strong for them to oppose.
Now, you made a great and a fair point about, you know, the fact that you like that this is coming up from the players and players are connecting. I will say that I really wish that baseball had something similar like the NBA. You know, after you had the postponements the other day, there's a conference call, the most powerful and influential sport, people in the sport are involved. You have players, Adam Silver, et cetera. I wish baseball had that. But it just feels like it's a million miles away from that, which I felt like was kind of what Jack Flaherty was referring to in his tweet.
Yeah. And what Jack Flaherty said is not at all unreasonable. It's just pie in the sky right now. And a lot of this, Buster, goes back to the fact that I don't think the players have all that much respect for the commissioner's office and for the person sitting in the seat there. I mean, there is animus still from not just this past spring when they couldn't figure out how to get a deal to get back on the field, but from the years beforehand. A lot of that blame is cast toward Rob Manfred. And so I think eventually, hopefully, they will get to the point where those conversations are being had, because I do think that there are very smart, very well-intentioned people at Major League Baseball who want to join in the movement and who want to support players. But I think there is going to be ugliness. There is going to be divisiveness in the early stages of any movement. And so I think we're going to get past that. We have to get past that point before those conversations are really substantive and really affect change. And they will happen. They will take place. I don't know how productive they're going to be early on, but I'm like you, man. I hope that in the end, this becomes a collaborative thing sport-wide, because I think that would be That would be bringing baseball to a place where it has not been for a long, long time.
And I think you would agree with me that that's never going to happen unless they actually have a collaborative, cooperative negotiation and agreement with the next CBA, you know, which the current one set to expire December 21.
Yeah, good luck.
Yeah, I know. I'm with you.
As somebody who has children, I see evolution that comes off as minor miracles. Like, oh my God, I never thought my kid was going to get to the point where he was going to actually be kind and not whine. And yet here we are on a day where my children are acting wonderfully toward me. I'd like to believe baseball will get to that point, but oh man, it's going to take a long, 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 long way to get there and a lot of effort from both sides that I just don't know is particularly realistic.
Speaking of Rob Manfred, last night, Brody Van Wagenen had a hot mic moment. We played it at the top of the show. Are you taking the explanation at face value? I just put it on a tee for you, Jeff. You can do take it any way you want.
Here's the thing. Let's suppose that what Brody Van Wagenen said in his apology and what friend Jeff Wilpon said in there, I don't know what those things were, but in their statements are true. Let's just suppose that's the case. Brody Van Wagenen's criticism of Rob Manfred does not go away because he didn't come up with that idea. The criticism that he levied against him about high-level thinking, about feel in the moment, he was trying to show that this particular thing that he suggested Rob Manfred came up with was illustrative of a bigger picture issue, not that individual moment. So, and that is a criticism buster that has been levied by others around the sport. It's just never been done on a live microphone. And that's the sort of thing when Brody Van Wagenen says, hey, just the three of us talking here, you know, this was not meant to be disseminated to the world because he was saying something that goes against the most powerful man in the sport. And you see what the fallout is. The fallout is statements from the New York Mets owner and COO that essentially are, please, dear leader, do not hurt us for what we have done and for how our employee has sinned. Like, it was the most capitulation I have ever seen from an owner toward an authority figure that throws their employee not just under the bus, Buster, but like the bus ran Brody Van Wagenen over to the point where he might as well have been one with the pavement. Like, it was unbelievable to see. They didn't even spell the guy's first name right. He's been your general manager for 2 years, and you have the disrespect to misspell his name? Both of you guys? The whole night was just such a catastrophic intersection of 2020, the year, and the New York Mets, the franchise.
We got about 7 minutes left. And I want to ask you another question about this and also get trade deadline stuff. Look, if I work for Rob, I completely agree with your breakdown there. If I work for Rob today, I would tell him, forget the disagreement, the misunderstanding, whatever that was, who cares? That dismissive tone that Brody had toward Rob is something I hear all the time this year. All the time from front offices around baseball. There is enormous frustration with Rob. And by the way, there is great respect for Dan Halen, Morgan Sword, people in the Major League Baseball's commissioner's office. So this is not just, you know, the kids being upset with all the teachers. This is legitimate frustration with Rob in what is perceived to be a lack of leadership and not being out front and not communicating first and foremost. You know this. There hasn't been, while he's had calls with the managers, there hasn't been regular communication at all with the general managers. That has driven them crazy. The fact that in big moments, he's not coming out and giving out statements. 2 days ago, when we had the first postponements, the statement that was put out by Major League Baseball, again, no name attached to it, Rob did put out a statement last night in defending himself. That sort of thing is driving front offices crazy, Jeff. Have you heard the same?
Yeah. And here's the thing. I think that it is very easy to criticize leadership, right? Like that is something that is done not just in baseball. You see it in the NFL with Roger Goodell. You see it in the NHL with Gary Bettman. You see it to a much lesser extent, though, in the NBA with Adam Silver. And so the frustration with Rob Manfred is very real. I think some of it is reasonable. I think some of it's unfair. I think the idea that Rob Manfred does not like baseball, which is something that has taken root and something that he addressed in a conversation with Bill Shaken, I think it was yesterday in the LA Times. I do not believe that Rob Manfred dislikes baseball. I'm sorry. I feel like if you have the job as commissioner of baseball, you almost inherently have to like baseball, and that sometimes people conflate the idea of wanting to change things with disliking it. That said, Rob Manfred has put his foot in his mouth a number of times publicly, whether it was talking with Carl Ravitch about the piece of metal or coming out, you know, publicly on ESPN and saying, I'm worried about the season, a couple days after saying we are unequivocally 100% going to have the season. The public perception of Rob Manfred is not good. And all this does is fuel that fire and lend credence to the idea, which is why I think you saw Brody Van Wagenen apologize so vociferously and why you saw the Wilpons come out with these statements that were excessively deferential to the point where it was like, okay, if you're coming in and saying these things, is Rob Manfred scared of something? Like, why are you going this far? Why does the lady protest so much? And it was, I think it was a fascinating insight into this. And just the fact, I was like, Buster, I was wondering, is there a more Mets screw up that you have seen? Because maybe it's recency bias for me, but this thing jumped to the very top of the list in my mind.
Well, and I'm, you know, I'm self-centered, so I'm going to go to an example that I covered that has always stuck with me. In 1997, when I covered the Mets, Bobby Valentine was the manager, and during spring training, one of their pitchers, I don't want to put his name out there again because I feel like he's a good guy and I'm just dragging him through it, but there was a pitcher on the team who Bobby got word that this pitcher who was injured at the time was moonlighting in a beer league softball league for a team entered by a strip club. And Bobby was like, there's no chance that that's true. And so he went in disguise, as Bobby described it, you know, as Bobby is wont to do. He went to the field to see if this was possibly true, that a pitcher on the disabled list would actually be playing softball. And yes, there was his guy, the ringer slugger for the strip club. That to me was the most Mets moment. But there's so many we can choose from.
there really are. Do you know the name? Was it like Chico's Bail Bonds, where the strip club was on the jersey?
Yes, it was, and I had it. You know, it was a lot when I wrote the story. It was in the piece, but I can't remember off the top of my head. It was a long time ago.
I am gonna have to go to the New York Times archives for that one because that is too good. I never thought I was gonna go to the search bar on the New York Times website and type in Bobby Valentine strip club, but here we are, Buster.
Exactly. And here we are in 2020. We got about 3 minutes left, and that's all the time we're going to do with the trade deadline. And I don't know if we necessarily need more time than that. What's hot?
I will say this, and this has been really interesting. I've talked to three general managers over the past couple of days who said, I've been dealing with social justice stuff. I haven't had a single conversation about trades because having to figure out what the deal is with players and look, lower level, the duty falls on lower level personnel at that point. But when trades get done, they're getting executed by presidents of baseball operations, general managers. And if they're dealing with what is deemed higher level stuff than that right now, all that does is push things even further back. I mean, we've had like two trades at this point. And Taiwan Walker, the biggest name move so far, and that was for a player to be named later. I figured it was going to be a dud of a deadline, and I don't see the Reds moving Trevor Bauer, for example. You want, like, the price is enormously high on Lance Lynn, though. There is an expectation that he is going to be the biggest name moved. Clevinger at this point, a big ol' who knows. The talent is there, but is the will for the Indians, now that they've brought him back into the fold, to deal him? That's a tough one to see.
Yeah, it's just a strange year, and any team that would be acquiring a player would only get that player for 27 days. And a question I hear a lot is it really that? Is it worth it? Is it worth the price and everything that you would go through, especially given all the uncertainties as we move forward? Jeff, thanks for doing this, and I hope you enjoy that story.
I am literally going to hang up the phone right now and immediately go to the New York Times website and find this, and
you will love it.
So,
and not because I wrote it, but the circumstances were so awesome.
No, you writing it even better, but this is, you've made my day. Thank you, Buster. I'm hanging up the phone right now so I can do this. Goodbye.
The 2024 NFL Draft heads to Detroit, and it's time to see who gets the job.
Caleb is a unique and special talent throwing the football.
And what sets them apart.
The Heisman Trophy winner is Jaden Daniels.
All of the greats were hired here.
What a throw by Mahomes.
See who gets the job.
Are you ready?
The 2024 NFL Draft begins Thursday, April 25th on ESPN, ABC, and NFL Network.
Todd Radom is the chief executive of our weekly quiz, a graphic artist whose work can be seen on ball fields all across America, all around the world, or you can go to his website, toddradom.com. Todd, how you doing this week?
Doing well, Buster. How are you?
I'm hanging in there. Excited to go to Philadelphia this weekend. Little Phillies Braves on Sunday Night Baseball. Before we get to this week's quiz, let's talk about Progressive Field in Cleveland. We're now hitting the American League Central. I'll tell you, it's one of my favorite ballparks. And part of it is that, you know, I love the people who work with the Indians, you know, Terry Francona, Chris Antonetti, Bart Swain, media relations. They're just great people. Francisco Lindor. But I've always liked that ballpark, even when I first went there as a beat writer covering the Orioles for the Baltimore Sun.
Yeah, I'm with you, Buster. I can remember visiting there. I worked the 1995 World Series for MLB. And honestly, I think, you know, few ballparks rocked the way that place did then. Most recently, and this is almost hard to believe here in the year of the plague, my most recent visit there was for the 2019 All-Star Game, right? And summing it up, I think it's safe to say that this stadium has really aged gracefully over the past quarter century. That's hard to believe, too. So Progressive Field, I think it comfortably passes our all-important sense of place test, right? You know where it is. It has this epic view of Terminal Tower and downtown Cleveland. And I'm always struck by the fact that the ballpark literally embraces the skyline of Cleveland. It's a cool looking place. The interior, I think the exterior architecture, which is all this white steel girder work, seems almost transparent, especially compared to some of its solid brick contemporaries like Camden Yards, Comerica, Coors Field. And in doing some research for this place, I found out that the stadium's designers were, in fact, inspired by the many and varied steel bridges that span the city of Cleveland. So apparently they painted the steel white in order to set it apart, make it more prominent, and to set it off from the Rust Belt stereotype that was such a big deal, of course, when this ballpark was built back in the early 90s. But here you go, Buster and Taylor. For me, the ballpark's 19 vertical light fixtures, those giant toothbrushes, those are the signature element that makes this park pretty unique looking, right?
Yeah, as you were going through it, I was like, okay, what about the candlestick lights? What about the candlestick lights? What about, and you saved the best for last. when you saw those for the first time, if you liked them.
Yeah, I did. I thought that was a very, again, you know, when Jacobs Field, let's call it, for the sake of just getting it right, was built, you know, it seemed like we were veering toward everything kind of looking like Camden Yards, you know, things that were quote unquote on paper. This was a couple of years after that. this doesn't look like Camden Yards. Camden Yards is beautiful, but this had a unique, again, sense of style and place. And also in preparing notes for today, I discovered that the reason that they did that is that technology was changing right at that time. And they figured that outfielders could track a ball better with this vertical configuration, which I had no idea.
Wow. I didn't know that either. Yeah. That's interesting.
I do have to talk about one very visible flaw. There's always, you know, some turn the punch bowl everywhere, right? And I think we'd probably agree. It's those giant right field patio areas that look like shipping containers that are fairly new. It's kind of like this gigantic blight on what's otherwise a beautiful package for me. But, you know, listen, in the scheme of things, not that big a deal.
You know what I always love is that you just see things that I'm never going to see, right? You never, this is a true story. There was a place where I worked on the 120 acre farm that I had back in Vermont, a place where I split wood probably for 10 years running. And a couple of years ago, I wound up acquiring that piece of property within a family transaction. And I was walking up in that place, Todd, in the same place where I had worked my whole childhood. And I looked up and I was like, oh my God, I've never seen that mountain over there. and that's me. And on the other hand, you notice something like you notice. So I always love that about our conversations. We can't go away without talking about what is known to some people as Municipal Stadium, but what is mostly referred to as the Mistake by the Lake, the ballpark the Indians played in before they played in Progressive.
I actually own four chairs from the old ballpark. They're sitting here in my hallway, Buster. And they are painted yellow. They arrived here with bubblegum stuck to the bottoms. They are rusting. But I think of all of the people who sat in those seats and watched terrible baseball for all of those years. But again, ballparks contain memories, good, bad, otherwise. I love them. But a couple of things. You know, that place was just gigantic. I can recall my favorite memory of having attended a game there. Took place on an opening day in the very early 90s, maybe the late 80s. And I just remember trudging through these muddy parking lots. It's Cleveland in early April, so let's say the weather was not quite optimal. But I'm there with a couple of buddies. And, of course, the place was just gigantic. The biggest crowd of the year, you know, in the 70,000-plus stadium was going to be an opening day. There was never pent-up demand for tickets. But maybe there were 40,000 people. I could be totally wrong. But we get into the ballpark, we're ready for baseball, get a hot dog from a vendor. It comes in a foil-wrapped package. I bite into the thing. It is cold, and not only that, Buster, but I did distinctly bite into some bones in that hot dog. The Cleveland Stadium experience.
I thought you were going to have, like, some sort of a rat ending the thing, or maybe a block of ice that you bit into, you chipped a tooth, something. But you know what? That's good. All right, let's get to this week's quiz.
All right, guys, here we go. Simple. This club has played in four divisions. Is it A, the Astros, B, the Brewers, C, the Tigers, or D, the Braves? Four divisions across its history. Astros, Brewers, Tigers, Braves.
Oh, boy. Oh, man. Go ahead, Taylor. I know I could figure out the answer if I took more time, but my brain's kind of mush this morning. What do you got, Taylor?
I'm going to go Tigers.
Okay, well, that's definitely not the right answer. I tell you right now. So I have an opportunity here. If I just take a little bit of time, Astros, give it to me again.
Astros, Brewers, Tigers, Braves.
I can hear you typing over there, Buster.
No. Okay. Astros, Brewers, Tigers, Braves. Astros, Brewers, Tigers, Braves. It's not the Braves. So Astros, Brewers, because obviously the Astros moved to the other division. I'm going to go with the Astros.
You're both wrong. It's the Brewers.
Yes.
I needed just a few more seconds.
The Brewers played in the AL West when they, right? They
oh,
played,
yes.
Which, stupid. And, oh, after they God. Shifted.
Yes, yes.
AL East, AL right, AL Central, NL Central. It's the Brewers.
It's the trade deadline. The sport's falling apart, Todd. It's 2020. I totally screwed that up. I missed an opportunity. I'm sorry. I'm a complete failure.
Well, at least you'd never serve me a bony hot dog.
Thanks, Todd.
All right, guys.
Bleacher Tweets.
Alrighty, Buster. Bleacher Tweets for Friday. First up here, we got Cameron Everhart at Cameron Everhart 1. No T in there. He writes in, Buster, as I was listening to you on Geo's No-No, I couldn't help but wonder why the catcher's name is not included in the No-No stats. What are the odds they are going to start including catcher's name in future No-Nos?
No, I don't think they would. I mean, as the pitcher's doing 99% of the work, as the catchers will tell you, you know, over time you do begin to compile. Like I think Jeff Torborg caught, if I remember correctly, Sandy Koufax's perfect game, and I think he caught like Nolan Ryan no hitter at some point. And we remember that, you know, catchers having multiple no hitters, but it's not the same as the pitchers.
Last one for the week, Jacob Stack at Jacob Stack 11 writes in, do the Dodgers need to get a top-end starter to join Kershaw and Buehler to solidify a stronger playoff starting rotation, or will a combination of Urias, May, and Gonsolin do the trick?
Yeah, I think they're okay. The Dodgers, as of today, I was looking at this morning, Jacob, based on your question, they're 24-9, their run differential is plus 86. If you were to project that over 162 games, they're on a pace to win 117. With a run differential of plus 422. I think the Dodgers are okay at this point.
That does it for Bleacher Tweets. Thanks for writing in, everyone. Send in some good ones over the weekend and enjoy the weekend because summer's basically over, Buster. It's kind of a bummer, but
we get another week. We have Labor Day's not till next week. Listen to you.
I know. I'm feeling down about it. Anyway, thanks, all everyone. Right.
That's it for today. My thanks to Jeff, to Todd, to Taylor. Have a great weekend, everybody. Thanks for listening. Stay safe. And remember, hate and inequality based on skin color is something we must fight against every single day.
Thanks for listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast. If you're playing fantasy baseball, don't forget to listen to the Fantasy Focus podcast. Check out all podcasts at ESPN.com/podcenter. Baseball Tonight, the podcast.